Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Caught Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from just outside of New York City from an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
It's going to take me a long time to get over that yesterday. I'm telling you, what a sickener. Hey, for United fans who think I've been unfair to them for the last few years, I don't think I have. I think I've been accurate about them. But
you've been very mean, though.
My uppance has come. Oh, I shattered. Wrecked the national holiday for me. Wrecked. Absolutely St. Patrick's Day. Ruined.
We will get deep into that one because it was, I mean, look, I don't know. We'll do our devunlings at the end of the year. We do a match of the season. Like, that comes from the Premier League, so this is ineligible. This was the FA Cup. But if you see a better game than what you got yesterday than that, then good for you, because that was just spectacular.
From a neutral standpoint, that's, I mean, our Man United standpoint, anyone's standpoint, really. And in the fullness of time when my wounds are healed, I'll probably feel the same way. But that's an iconic game. An all-timer. I think the FA Cup needed it, too. Because we'll talk about Coventry City and the American angle to that, but like, you know, look at the teams that are in the semi-finals. It's a bit bland, you know. It's what's the difference between it and the League Cup when you see the same teams all the time? So the FA Cup needed a brilliant game like that, and it got it. And United needed this. Manchester United have never needed it more than they needed it now, and they got it. You know, there's so much to talk about with Ten Hag. Mm-hmm. Was there a Mark Robbins moment for Ten Hag? We'll get into that too. We'll get into Mark Robbins as well, who is writing his own story, a second story for Mark Robbins in the FA Cup. Amazing weekend. And we've got Theo Lloyd-Hughes talking about the NWSL, which came back this weekend. I've got my Inter Miami watch, which is, I will continue to watch them until they implode and do exactly what I want them to do.
Wow.
Yeah, hasn't happened yet. But that, I'm rattled.
Let's just go right into it then, and really explore these feelings that you're experiencing. Because honestly,
they're
feelings that Liverpool fans feel, I would say, on instances that are few and far between in this era. I mean, that is not, you're not accustomed to what went down. That's usually you doing that to someone else.
Exactly. And that was pointed out to me by a friend of mine who I met afterwards, who watched it at the Monroe. I watched it at home on my sofa. And he said, look, we've done this so many times to other teams. To be on the end of it is a unique experience. Tell you what, I don't like it.
No, it's not much fun, is it?
Nope.
It's not a whole lot of fun. This game had everything. I mean, honestly, it had everything. Lead changes, dramatic equalizers, and a stunning winner. And it's all set amidst a backdrop of being a derby, like a uniquely important derby, Klopp's final FA Cup run, And Erik ten Hag setting this up as a match that could save United's season. I mean, this was like the narratives were all there. They were all laid bare for the world to see, and it lived up to it. There's so much that stood out from this one. I guess I'll start with just from the Liverpool side of it. I'll ask you, allowing four goals, were there any cracks within Liverpool that you saw in this one that you thought, oh, I don't know. I don't like that. I mean, Craig Burley on the broadcast was destroying Liverpool for the first goal. They're all ball watching as McTominay comes in. I mean, there was some things that you don't normally see with Liverpool.
No. I know the first thing to be noted, like having three Man United defenders running at poor Conor Bradley towards the end, or three United attackers running at one Liverpool defender towards in the lead up to the final goal. Like, you know, there is a way that Liverpool play. And the game had become so open that it suited a counter-attacking team like Manchester United. But the intensity wasn't there from the start, Andrew. They were, like, Liverpool were so far off it from an intensity standpoint. Like, it was jarring, the opening, we'll say, 20 minutes. And then United kind of, you know, they settled into what they usually are. They made mistakes trying to play out the back, which they're still no good at doing. Liverpool capitalized. And then at halftime, you're like, Liverpool are leading. How has this happened? But the general Liverpool performance was way off it. It was a fall off in intensity. United played like this really mattered. And as Craig Burley said in the commentary, I thought Craig actually was really good as a co-commentator with John Champion yesterday. Because a lot of the things that he said or prophesized came through, because he kept saying, it's so casual.
He even cursed once. You don't hear hell very often in the commentary, but he's so genuine.
All right, Ned Flanders, hockey stick.
I'm not saying I had a problem with it. I'm just saying, look at that, a curse word in the commentary.
Yeah. He said, Liverpool so casual, Salah so casual. There was a couple of times when Liverpool were like streaking away like the Red Arrows, and you're like, just put it in the net and finish this at 2-1. And honestly, it was such a bizarre game that United deserved to win it, but also could have been beaten, but also were better on XG, but also Liverpool probably should have seen it out. Like, and I think the fact Liverpool didn't get that third goal to make it 3-1 is the difference in this game when they had those chances. And then Antony, of all people, to be the guy to bring it to extra time, you know, I did not feel stressed as that game ticked down. I did not feel stressed at all. I thought, we're going to see this out as a 2-1. And up pops Antony with a clever little turn, slides it past Kelleher. And then the next thing you know, there's 30 minutes to be added. And
it nearly didn't even come to that. I mean, I thought Marcus Rashford was going to call. Now, maybe he was offside.
Didn't. Oh, well, I don't know about that. Yeah. It's such a good first touch. And then the finish is so poor, really, for having set himself up like that. You could say Kelleher closed the angle down, made it hard for him, but he still should score. A truly bizarre end-to-end kind of game. I will say this. I think United deserved it in the end. I think Liverpool are responsible for their own drop-off in play. That's nothing United can do. United brought an intensity to it. They also responded to the blows that they got. I mean, to be 1-0 up and then possibly could have been 2-0 up, except for a brilliant save from Kelleher. And then, you know, the difference about United in this game from almost any other game was, and again, it was alluded to by Craig Burley, was that at 2-1, they didn't throw in the towel, because we've seen them fall apart. They don't take getting punched in the face very well. And they got punched in the face several times yesterday and came back and still won it. And what a moment at the end for that young man to score at the Stretford end, the walk-off.
It was unbelievable.
And then to be sent off for taking off his shirt. By the way, that rule needs to be revised, because ultimately he doesn't care about being sent off, because he gets a hero's ovation going down the tunnel. But like, he wasn't bare-chested. He had a training top underneath. Am I right?
Yeah.
Like, so yeah. What's the is there a moral? Like, what is the issue with bear, with like revealing your chest in the yellow card?
I don't quite understand it either. I would have.
We
no
were
problem
always told. I was as I, when this came in years ago, as a younger person, we labeled under the idea that it was, oh, you know, it's not, you know, it's a family sport. You know, heaven forbid we'd see, you know, abs or, you know, chest. I mean,
we've all been to the beach. Like, what's the problem?
Yeah, I don't get it. I think it's arcane. But anyway, yeah, just
before we move off of that, can we, I mean, I don't want to see you cry and weep on this podcast, but I do think it's a moment worth reliving. Here was the call yesterday.
Elliot robbed. Here's Garnacho. Ahmad, who stole the ball, gets it back from Garnacho to the young man. Can he make himself a hero? He has done. It's Manchester United's quarter-final. In classic Manchester United fashion, the counter-attack. And a youngster doing it as well.
You know, it's an unbelievable moment. And something about it that I thought was really, really interesting. So when it happened, there's this moment that came to mind for me instantaneously, and I wonder if the same is true for you. It's a moment that we've referenced many times on this podcast over the years when you see situations similar to this develop, and that was 2018 World Cup, Belgium and Japan. And this felt so similar to that, the corner being taken at one end, and then next thing you know, there's one little breakdown, and then, oh my God, we thought we were having a set piece to win this game. Now we're going the other way and we're losing it. And the thing that was so interesting to me, so that happened in 2018 to Japan. Wataru Endo was on the bench that day for Japan, and he watched that happen. He wasn't on the field, but he was on the bench for that Japanese team. He watched that corner go down in stoppage time, and then Belgium go back the other way, and Nasser Chadli wins it in the fourth minute of stoppage time and knocks Japan out. Endo was on the field, and he, along with Harvey Elliott, that took two to tango in the situation, but the two of them were very much at fault for this being able to spring back the other way and Manchester United and go on and win the game. I just thought it was kind of an interesting piece of symmetry that he was in some way tied to both of those moments.
It is really interesting, and it also highlights a certain xenophobia in the way we talk about football. What was being said, Andrew? What was being said about Japan at that moment in that game? Well, that's, you know, they're all gung-ho. That's the naivety of the Asian sides of Japan in particular, you know, that they were like just attack, attack, attack. Naivety, like a sense of a childlike mind when it comes to soccer, lacking the cynicism of the wiser European teams. Not what's been said about Klopp's side, and they did exactly the same thing. What's been said about Klopp's side is that it's a little bit like Ange Postecoglou. That's the way we play, mate. And it is the way they play. They threw everything forward, and they got caught out, and they got done.
But even with that, like the throwing everything forward, like it could have been okay. It took a moment.
It
took a mistake. Endo and Elliot, a ball came to each of them, and they kind of weren't sure who should take it. So neither one of them really did. And then United pounced.
I think if we're looking for a sign of tiredness for the first time from Liverpool, like they've been getting through games, the Carabao Cup final against Chelsea, you know, coming back and beating Forest late on in that dramatic fashion that they did. You know, I feel if you're looking for indicators that this side is tiring a little bit, it might have been yesterday's performance, because there was such a drop off from what they usually are. They went to the well, still got ahead, but it was United that looked fresher than them. And so it should be, considering the amount of games. But I honestly think, you know, United still deserved it in the end. They never fell out of the game in the way that you would suspect that they would do, or that United fans feared they would. They never did.
It was unbelievable belief from them to stay in that, to come back on two different occasions and then still have enough left to grab a winner. I mean, it was an amazing Manchester United performance. It's the defining game of their season. And Erik ten Hag said afterwards, he said, this could be the moment. The team has the belief and energy to do amazing things. When you beat Liverpool, you can beat anyone. Now,
and yet, I don't buy that.
Well, here's the problem.
And I don't think a lot of United fans do either. That's the thing.
Well, yeah. I just feel like we've said this 10 different times about United this season.
Agreed.
Now, the question that you have to ask is this time different than those other times? Because there are things about this that were particularly admirable. I mean, like I said, they came back twice against one of the best teams in the world. You know, the way they did it, guys are playing positions that are just not natural to them. Bruno's playing center back. Maguire's pushing up into attacking roles. Antony's at left back. Like, Ten Hag got these guys to buy into roles that are not their own, and they won doing it. I mean, that will bond a team. You know, some performances from this game. Kobbie Mainoo, 100% on dribbles completed. Garnacho, 5 chances created. Dalot was great in defense. Obviously, Amad Diallo coming on, imposing himself on the game as a sub and getting the winner. I mean, Phil McNulty of the BBC said this about Ten Hag afterwards. He said, this was the biggest and most spectacular result of Ten Hag's United career and may just be the result that gives him a long-term future at Old Trafford. Will it be a game changer for Ten Hag? Only time will tell, but a victory of such significance will not do him any harm as Ratcliffe plots United's route forward.
Well, so that's the main question coming out of this game for me. That was a spirited performance. That was a thing that lifted the Stretford end in a way it hasn't been lifted. Like, when's the last time you've seen the Stretford end pop off in quite that fashion?
Well, obviously, like, I mean, look, that's an FA Cup quarterfinal against Liverpool, so that's different.
Exactly.
Like we've said, they have had games this season that they've won at the
not
death.
Not like that.
But
not like
obviously that. Liverpool is a is a totally different beast.
So if you're here's the thing. If you're Dave Brailsford, the brains trust of INEOS, you know, the Sky Tour de France cycling team, marginal gains, data driven, all those things. And others that we will get into at some point, I'm sure. Do you look at that and think, right, that is an indicator of what this manager has created with the team, that is something that is sustainable, that game is something we've seen flickers of throughout the season and is an indicator that we are heading in the right direction? The answer would be no. It's not. And it's probably in a number of ways an outlier for United. And that's the problem. Liverpool, both in the way they played, but in the way they set up, are exactly the kind of opposition that United can thrive against. Because Ten Hag has said he wants to create this, you know, counter-attacking team, this team that can really hurt teams. And who's going to allow you that space? Who's going to come out and play? Most teams don't come out and play against Manchester United. And they do the opposite. Look at what Fulham did at Old Trafford. Is what Fulham did at Old Trafford a better indicator of United all season long or this game yesterday? That's the question. The answer is clear. We have too much evidence now that the squad needs overhaul and the manager hasn't really brought this team far enough forward. I got texts from and tweets from United fans afterwards. Can't wait till we lose. I can't remember the team. We'll just say Brentford. Can't wait till we take this hype into the next game we play and lose 3-0 or lose 2-1 or whatever. You know, and that is the feeling.
So that's the point.
Yeah.
Like that's the thing that I can't escape is like, and look, I do disagree with you a little bit about the United situation. I would be, if the choices are overhaul the squad or overhaul the manager, I'm more prone to lean towards overhauling the squad than the manager. I just don't think that they have good enough
players.
I've said that repeatedly. Yeah, I mean, I could see that, but I think Ten Hag, and look, some of that, as I know you've talked about at length, is Ten Hag's own doing. You know, with this new ownership group, maybe their scouting structure is different. Their transfer policies are different. Maybe it's not just Ten Hag says, I want Antony. You could buy him at all costs. Maybe it's not going to be like that anymore. I don't know. But I just think the team isn't quite good enough. But with regards to this, I mean, look, there's a lot of nice things being said about the team from the manager and the media about the manager and the team today. And that's all fine. Like, you should bask in the glow of a game like that. That's that's part of the
Absolutely.
Fun. All I would say is, don't you dare lose to Coventry City now. And like, this United team has not earned our trust for us to be able to say definitively that that won't happen. Like, let's just go through some of the resume. Dramatic Champions League win against Copenhagen when Onana saved that penalty. That was, I think, one of our first, is this a turning point moment? He struggled so much, gets the penalty. He's the hero now. Then they lose their next two versus City and Newcastle, 3-0, 3-0. The team, they had a dramatic feel good win against Aston Villa. 4 days later, they lost to Nottingham Forest. They smashed Crystal Palace in the League Cup. It was all coming together. We killed them. They lose to the same Crystal Palace team 4 days later in the league. They beat Fulham in stoppage time. They lose to Copenhagen 4 days later in the Champions League. Beat Chelsea, got smashed by Bournemouth 3 days later. Like, this is what they've been. So enjoy this on its own, but they're just hard to trust. Like, successes 1 week have not correlated with them to what happens next. So,
and don't forget, there was a certain cup final feel within a cup competition about this yesterday. I mean, yeah. if it had stayed 2-1, what are we talking about? Can't see Ten Hag staying on. Can't see him surviving that. And
again, my decision making with Ten Hag is not, it's not in these games against City and Liverpool and Arsenal. Like, those aren't the games when I'm making those decisions.
Right,
it's the weird losses. Like, those are the ones where I.
But it's like what Gary Neville said all season long. Like, show me the pattern of play. Show me the style of play. And it's so hard to discern. I think
what's encouraging, and I don't want it to become a negative United segment. This is their biggest win of the season.
Yeah, right.
Like,
okay.
What's encouraging is that there are guys on this team. If all you get out of the season, I don't know what's going to happen now in the FA Cup. They've got Coventry City, so I expect them, I don't know it, but I expect them to wind up in the final of this competition. Chances are that's going to be against Manchester City, and I would pick City to win. So I can't sit here and tell you that they're going to get a trophy out of the season right now. So if all you get is an appearance in an FA Cup final, and let's say they finish sixth in the league, maybe they're in the Europa League, you know, that's fine. But seeing, like, the real success here is that Garnacho, player.
Yep.
Kobbie Mainoo, player. Hoyland, before his injury, scoring in, what was it, 5 straight games. Like, there are young pieces on this team that you can start to say, I feel like for the first time in a little while, you can start to look at and say, okay, like, there is something here. There are young players here that you have reason to feel good about that can make this club one that is starting to feel like on the ascent, as opposed to what we felt the last several years.
And I think Garnacho, his ability, his nonstop running, he's like a cult hero already, not just for the bicycle kick goal, but for the effort he puts into games. And there have been games where he was the difference. Like, against Everton, he's literally the driving force in that side. I still think there's a lot to come out of Bruno Fernandes. He is frustrating. The lead up to the Liverpool, is it the Salah goal? That, you know, just falling over, looking for free kicks, stuff like that, leaving your team and like in an awkward position in the corner, like to allow that Gomez to come in, take the ball off you, not be stronger, and then complain about it. Yeah, he frustrates people and opponents and opposition fans, but there's something there. I think Mainoo and Garnacho, like, they are the things to come out of this season that you really think you could build around. But Andrew, they have so much deadwood to get rid of. Like, it's mind-boggling, the overhaul that's needed.
And I think new ownership, I think they know that. I don't think there's a head in the sand element to this. I think
they
understand.
Don't. Now, how quickly can they put in place the things that weren't in place before, which is the recruitment side? How quickly can they get that done? Because they can't go back to the old system. Well, you know, Christian Eriksen's available. Let's get him in on massive wages. Casemiro, we don't even know that he's washed. Real Madrid do, though. Let's get him in. You know, like, the reputation signings shouldn't be the thing from now on. It should be the kind of clever signings that Liverpool and to an extent City have been able to do over the past few years. You know, really build something here around that core of young players. Look, it's a great day for Manchester United. Let's keep it in its context for now. Maybe we should just really hone in on the fact that they've done the Scousers in the most devastating way possible. And by the way, my behavior was exemplary yesterday. Even when it looked like Liverpool were going to win twice, when it went 3-2 in extra time, when it was 2-1 and petering out, I was exemplary. There was no crowing, there was no text, there was nothing. I was magnanimous. I was Johnny Magnanimous.
Good for you. Good for you. That's nice to hear. Let's go to the Liverpool side of it. I mean, Ten Hag says it's the kind of game that could spur United onward. What about Liverpool? Can it do the reverse? Could this derail them in some way?
I don't know.
They don't play again until March 31st. I wonder if that helps them.
It does, or it knocks them. Maybe the rest is needed. Maybe this was a fatigued side that really was, and that was evident in their casual play, and that they need the break now. I don't know. There's the other side that you want games. Now, at this point of the season, you want game on game to maintain rhythm and all that. I don't know. There's probably a little from column A, a little from column B. It was concerning the way they played early on. The main concern for me was that they were not clinical when they should have been. And also the kind of brain fart. By the way, the weirdest moment. So I had soccer at McCarran Park at 8 a.m. in the morning. Cosmopolitan Soccer League game. And the Nunez mistake, playing it into traffic. It happened. Yeah. It happened. My friend Luke did it. I watched this twice in real time. He plays it into the center. Barnston worked the team we were playing, overturned the ball, ran in, scored, 1-0 down. And I'm like, God, that's annoying. That's frustrating. The same thing happened again then in this match. I'm like, am I eating crazy pills here or whatever? I don't know. So I'm watching this. I'm like, how can this be happening again? And you know, that kind of mental fatigue there. But the main concern for me was when there was a chance to bury United. Once that goes 3-1, they're not coming back. There's not enough time. They're not doing enough. You left them in it. And that's the worry for me as you go into a run-in.
They do return to Old Trafford in just a few weeks, April 7th. That should be fascinating.
Oh, my God.
With this as part of that backdrop. Finally, to close out, I mean, if you thought we were getting out of this segment without referencing this, then you just aren't familiar with
this. No, you don't know who Andrew is.
You've never listened to this program.
Andrew is, wow. Yeah.
So Jurgen Klopp was interviewed. We know, even by his own admittance, he's a sore loser. He knows it. We all know it. I can say that, and he would agree with me if he were here right now. He would yell at me, but then later on, he would agree with me about it. Here was his post-match interview, however brief it was, with Danish reporter Niels Christian Frederiksen after the match.
Normally, intensity is the name of your game, so how come it became so difficult in extra time?
A bit of a dumb question, I have to say, because when you see us that often, if you never saw us, then you can ask how can they have more resources. We played, I don't know how many games recently, I don't know how many games United exactly played. That's sport. Yeah. I'm really disappointed about that question, but you thought obviously it's good.
So too many games, so...
I don't think that. Ah, come on. You are obviously not in a great shape, and I have no nerves for you. I have a question talking about, are you really, what's wrong with you? What did you want now?
How come you're so provocative?
That's Jurgen. So this continues.
That wasn't good.
No, it's not a good look. I don't know if it was as bad as the Crystal Palace one. Yeah, you'll say the same thing to that. I still think that's my all-time favorite.
No, because that was so out of nowhere. But you know what I noticed, though? And I think it's Scandinavians and I'm lumping countries together. Scandinavians, and we know the Dutch. Did you see the interview last week? ESPN in Holland interviewed Jordan Henderson after Ajax had a draw. A poor performance, but a point. And the bluntness, they basically said, why were you so poor? Why were you so bad? And you individually, Jordan. And he dealt with it pretty well, considering, you know, he was like, well, the only reason it wasn't a really poor performance is because we didn't lose. And the guy just went on to kind of just rip him apart, but in the most like just blunt, plain fashion.
Yeah.
Devoid of emotion. And I felt like this was the same thing too here. Now,
well, this reporter was Danish. He wasn't Dutch.
I know. No. I'm putting the Dutch and the Scandinavians together.
Gotcha.
Allow me to do that.
So he was tracked down and he was interviewed then. I'm reading here from the BBC. Danish reporter Niels Christian Frederiksen insists he has, quote, absolutely no problem after facing an outburst from Jurgen Klopp following Liverpool's FA Cup loss at Manchester United. A clip of the Liverpool manager angrily ending a post-match interview with Frederiksen for Viaplay went viral on social media on Sunday evening. Frederiksen says the exchange continued after the camera stopped rolling. Quote,
yeah.
It continued after what was seen on TV. He continued down the hallway where he yelled and screamed at me. I also followed him because I thought it was something strange, Frederiksen told Danish sports magazine Tipsa Bladet on Monday. Klopp was frustrated by questioning about his team's intensity during the, yada yada. Quote, I interpret mostly as an expression of his terrible frustration that they lost to Manchester United in the manner it happened, yeah. Where they were ahead twice and should have sealed the deal, Frederiksen added. Then he got a question about why they didn't have intensity in the game, and then he snapped. That's fair enough. I have absolutely no problem with that. There will be absolutely no problems in the future. I can't imagine that at all. When I interview him again, we'll still be good friends, professionally speaking. I don't think he holds a grudge, and I certainly don't. And so that's that, JJ, that's, the interviewer's thoughts on the matter.
Listen, I've done post-match interviews, but no, like never at that level, like League of Ireland level. Sure. So, actually, no, that's not true. I've done MLS post-match interviews and yeah, you can, I irritated Thierry Henry once by suggesting, did you just want the ball kicked longer to you, Thierry? He's just stood there. And by the way, he's trying to get into the shower. I'm here asking these questions, like, and he's like, you know. So I think, don't forget, like, Viaplay are the rights holders for the FA Cup in Scandinavia, and Klopp will have had to do that with the FA Cup's own in-house journalists, the BBC. ITV, yada, yada, yada. So that might be 8 of 10 interviews he's done. And he snapped.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he gave a conference also with the media at large. Yeah. I don't know the order in which these things occurred. I don't know what was before. So it's hard
for
me to
say. Like that? No.
He's a sore loser. That's all it is. He knows it. We all know it.
We're all acting like, and I do think he's got the Liverpool manager and the success of Liverpool lately and his aura. People, especially opposition fans, they love to see him crack. Because then they can say, you're disgraceful, blah, blah, blah. Because it's usually always so positive around Klopp, and he's such a nice guy. And here he is meeting a disabled kid from Northern Ireland and treating him so well that people get sickened by this aura of him being what he is at his core. Genuinely good person at his core.
JJ. It's not just that. With all the success that he's had, he's so bombastic. He's so loud. He's so emotional. So how many times has he beaten a team in the 94th minute and gone absolutely crazy? And that's at our expense as fans of the other team. We've seen him, Everton fans, I still hear it all the time from Everton fans. They'll never forgive him for running onto the field. They'll never let that go, ever. So seen him experience so much. Yeah. So much joy and over the
top. So it's nice to see him crack.
There are fans that want to that enjoy seeing that.
100%.
Because we've seen it on the other side so many times.
But you know, the thing for me is, and again, I'm old now, and I have to accept that most people or a lot of younger watchers won't have seen the things I've seen. Like, I see Fergie lose his S on a regular basis.
And by the way, people loved that too.
Yeah,
this is not unique to Klopp.
Fergie was the king of drops. It's not unique to him. That's the only thing.
Here's my question.
As a former journalist, we'll say, or former reporter, you shouldn't treat people that way. Like, you should be able to have a robust back and forth. Yeah, definitely. If you feel like someone's taking a hand at you, get back into it, get involved. But don't, I think he was too disrespectful, you know, with the calling it a dumb question. This is not this man's first language. Talking about the lack of intensity. Well, like, if you look at all the games Liverpool have played and that game in and of itself, of course there's going to be a drop in extra time. How do you keep going doing that? But he could easily have said, well, I think you've probably answered your own question there. In extra time, there was a drop in intensity, because there always is.
100%.
Do it that way. Yes. You don't have to be that rude to him.
Basically. Here's my only final thing on this. And I should say, I'm actually not mad at Klopp. Like, I think using the word dumb, like, that's language.
You hate him.
I don't hate him. That's not fair. And that's not true. There are things about him that annoy me. I've always been clear on that. I don't hate what happened here, because I can respect the emotion of a game like that. That was not just some game. That was unique. That was something different. Here's my only question about this. Clearly, we've come to learn, you know, we learn different qualities and traits in different managers, things that they like, things that bother them. Over the years, we've gotten to know Klopp well enough to know fixture congestion. That's a hot button thing for him. And while the question wasn't directly about that, he kind of brought it to that in the way he answered it. So here's my question for him. Not just him, a lot of managers complain about this. Like, there are certain circumstances where I get it. Like Manchester City going to a competition like the Club World Cup, which is thrust in the middle of the season. You got to travel to Saudi Arabia, play multiple games in it now. Like, you know, when the World Cup was jammed into the middle of the season, Barcelona being asked to fly to Texas for a friendly during a season. Like, you know, basically when extra things are added to a team's plate that wouldn't typically be there to navigate, I get it. But sometimes when I hear managers complain about fixture congestion, I don't get it. And I don't know who they're mad at. Everyone plays 38 matches in the league. Everyone is entered into the League Cup. Everyone's entered in the FA Cup. The best clubs qualify for European competitions. And if you're really good, you advance in those competitions, which means you play more games. Like, part of being one of the best teams like Liverpool also means, your roster is going to be filled with guys who play on national teams. So they have those games too. But like, these are all long established facts of the game. There's no surprises here. I just don't, in situations like this, like, I don't think Liverpool have been unfairly done. Like, I just don't always know who's he mad at. Like, what are the, like, This is this is the sport. Like, I don't know what else there is. You're good. So you play a lot of games. Like, I don't know.
Himself and Guardiola were in lockstep. There's too many games. There's like, and I really do think that they want one less competition to play in for sure. And then Guardiola.
Then play your under 23s in the League Cup. But Pep is obsessed with winning.
We've done that before. But Guardiola is obsessed with winning that. So, yeah. And so, as is Klopp in a way now recently. So, look, Guardiola did the sensible thing and he stopped talking about it. You know, get Ferran Soriano to talk about it, you know, and don't be you going out talking about it. One last thing from this game. Yeah. This was in a text exchange with a Manchester United supporter. So, they saw the same as I did at halftime in the extra time that the camera pans to Klopp and I just text interesting contrast between the managerial vibes there. Klopp just pure energy and passion. Ten Hag looking like he's explaining why your tax refund will be smaller this year. It was so like it was jarring to watch the two of them. Like
they're very different personalities.
Oh yeah,
Ten Hag is way more understated, obviously, and Klopp is the most emotional man in sports. Like they're very different.
Yeah, well, he got his win. He got his flower. So well done to everyone. And but I mean it. Yeah, I mean it. Yeah. That's going to take me some time to get over.
That was an unbelievable loss. That was.
Great game.
We'll go through. I mean, we obviously just spent a lot of time on that one. Like I said, it was probably the game of the season.
Yeah, well, what are we going to do? Not talk about it?
Right. No, that's the thing. So we'll go through some of the other, obviously, the other FA Cup quarterfinals as well.
I didn't see Chelsea versus Leicester, so you can handle that one.
Chelsea top Leicester City in what was also a six-goal thriller with a lot that went on in this game. Chelsea going up 2-0. Leicester City are in the midst. I mean, I know that they had been flying in the Championship. They've hit the skids of late. They're still in good position.
But they'll be fine.
So like they'll be okay. But
ooh,
but
yeah.
Not playing,
but look
though.
At that. Look how tight it is, though. We should give a quick Championship update. Like Southampton are in fourth on 73 points. This, by the way, apart from Ipswich, this is the parachute payment. Championship. Ipswich Town still holding their own up from League One last season on 81 points. They're in third. Leicester, 82. Leeds United top on goal difference with 82. They're tight on points. Oof.
It's gotten tight, and it looked like Leicester were going to coast.
In like a flash.
Yeah, well, they've been really poor lately. They went down two goals. It felt like this was going to be just sort of, you know, add this to the list of things that have gone wrong for Leicester of late, and they fight back. And it's 2-2, but then Chelsea, with a couple subs that come on, they wound up getting the winner in stoppage time and then another one from Madueke to seal it out. And they win 4-2. It was really it was a very exciting game. Chelsea had so many chances. Raheem Sterling had such a weird game. He had, you know, he draws a penalty. He misses the penalty. He has chances in front of goal. He puts shots wide, but then he comes back and he sets up a goal with a great assist. He just had such a weird game. And then Pochettino spoke afterwards with some interesting comments because he was booed. He made some substitution decisions that the fans did not like. He was booed. The "you don't know what you're doing" chants were unleashed on him. And it wasn't lost on him. He heard it. He was asked about it afterwards. And he said, "I'm not the manager here to do what the people want," Pochettino said. "Also, I'm not stupid. I did it to go again. For me, I saw Mudrick. We analyzed. He was tired and doing some stretching. We thought maybe he will not finish the game, and we decided to go first for Mudrick and then for Raheem. I think the crowd wanted Mudrick to stay on and wanted Sterling out. That's because we need to see everything. We are professional. We want to win, but of course, completely understand the situation. That doesn't mean that I agree, but look, we are going to support Mudrick, Raheem, and all the players in the squad. I not only ask the fans to trust me, they need to trust the club, because in the end, if I'm here, it is the decision of the club, and they need to trust the project of the club as well as me and the club." That was a very interesting way of saying, just trust me. He started out by saying, "you don't need to trust me," and he finished by saying, "trust me." They need to trust that the club is doing what they think is good for the club and for the fans. It is about trusting everyone. These comments are interesting to me if you can sort of sift through. He doesn't want to come right out and say,
"you don't trust me because I have the stench of Spurs on me."
Well, there is, I do believe that there is some of that, but I think he just doesn't, you know, I like Pochettino, and I don't think he just wants, he's not going to just come out and say, "blindly trust me." I don't think he's that kind of arrogant, but he is sort of trying to get them to do that in his comments here. And it's interesting because, look, I do get it from his perspective. A lot of injuries, lots of new players, inherited a team that was bottom half of the table last year, and he's gotten to one cup final, and he's back in Wembley for a semifinal. But look at it from the supporters' perspective. Like, you're not, who are you to these people other than, like you just said, JJ, a guy with Tottenham stench all over him? Like, yeah. Trust is earned.
Yep.
You're bottom half of the league right now. The football has, like, it's been very inconsistent. Sure, they got to a cup final, but what was the story that came out of that? People were disgusted that they didn't go for it when they had their chance to win in extra time. So, like, he's not word for word saying blindly trust me, but it's kind of what I translated some of that to be. And when you're 11th in the table or whatever they are they 11th, 12th? I forget. But like, fans aren't going to do that. This club has been, they've poured a fortune into this. And that's not translated yet. So I get it. Like, yeah, do I think chance of you don't know what you're doing are a little bit harsh when Pochettino's taking a player off because he thinks he's about to get injured? Like, yeah, that is harsh. But if you asked Pochettino, like, do you think you've earned their trust? Like, could he say with a straight face, yes? Like, no, they haven't been good enough. So I see both sides of it. It's an interesting one, this relationship with him and that fan base. I don't know if... Look, if they go on and beat City, that's the only way you earn trust. Win games that people don't think you're supposed to win. Show everyone that you're a genius. And I don't know that he can say he's done that yet. So it's an interesting one. Yeah, very interesting. Let's see. Manchester City, JJ, they beat Newcastle. It was another inevitable performance. They were really good.
Newcastle had two shots, one on target. Forget about it.
I don't have much on that. Apologies to the City fans that wanted us to do more, but my guess is you will be in this competition for a while longer and there will be plenty of chances for us to talk about you. And then JJ, Coventry City, they stun Wolves. In stoppage time, they get one to equalize. And then lo and behold, here they come again, pushing for a winner with extra time beckoning. But no, we got no use for extra time because what we got is Haji Wright. Let's listen to it.
O'Hare's done really well since he came up. Can they yet win it? Haji Wright goes to win it. Oh, my goodness me! Coventry have won it! In the 100th minute! Would you believe this?
Oh, listen. What a moment. That is literally a forever moment in the FA Cup. We should kind of reflect a little bit on Coventry. Coventry won the FA Cup in 1987, beating who in the final, Andrew?
Spurs?
Yep. Keith Houchin's goal was the winning goal there. So, like, Coventry used to be a Premier League mainstay. They've fallen down the divisions. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But that moment for Haji Wright, just exceptional. Like, a wonderful moment. That is him engraved in the FA Cup. The FA Cup doesn't throw up many shocks for Premier League teams anymore, but this is one of them. And just... I got to see him play for the New York Cosmos, Andrew. His career has been, like, he's only 25, but he started off at the Cosmos in 2015, Schalke, reserves, Schalke 4, then he went to Sandhausen on loan, VVV Venlo, Sondreski, Antalyaspor in Turkey, and now Coventry. Like, he's had one of the journeyman careers, but he's flying now 13 goals in 25
and made a World
Cup
team with that.
Made a World Cup team as well. Like, he's one of those guys where he feels like maybe a little bit out of place because of his size. You know, you're thinking, he's 6'3". He's technically decent. Is he just like a kind of a throwback player born out of his time? But like, just a actually really, really good technical finish as well. Strokes at home. Gets his manager in trouble. Not really. His manager got himself in trouble by celebrating in front of a ball boy. You saw that?
No,
Mark
actually.
Robbins. Yeah, Mark Robbins. So Gary O'Neill described it as disgusting. He just went like in this kid's face
after
Wright scored, because I think the kid had been smirking or annoyed him after that one of the Wolves goals. And he had
go on the Mount Rushmore of ball boy incidents next to Eden Hazard and Bruce Arena?
Nothing touches Hazard and the ball boy, who went on to become a CEO of a successful vodka company, would you believe? And was reunited with Hazard recently upon Hazard's retirement. So, like, weird, the weird world of football. What will this ball boy go on to do? Get involved in Big Pharma or something? Who knows? But anyway, so Mark Robbins Mark Robbins apologized, saying, "I shouldn't have done that. He's just a kid. Just a kid." Now, Mark Robbins, what a weekend for him. So, Mark Robbins,
I just watched it. I hadn't seen it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, why did he do that?
Yeah, because the ball boy had annoyed him earlier on.
Just so, of all the people to talk trash to after a moment like that, it's
when the greatest moment in Coventry's recent history, and that's what you do. But Mark Robbins, wow, Mark Robbins. So Amad Diallo might be the new Mark Robbins. Hopefully, he is a good because Mark Robbins is credited with saving Sir Alex Ferguson's career at United and kickstarting the whole success of the Fergie journey. It's the FA Cup fifth round. 1989, Manchester United travelled to Nottingham Forest, needing a win. Basically, the week before, bedsheets had been hung on the Stretford End saying, 3 years on and it's still crap. Tara Fergie, meaning out. The fans wanted him out.
Amazing.
And Mark Hughes puts in it, by the way, outside of the foot cross. Delicious one. It bounces up and Robbins heads home. Probably his most significant act as a footballer is to score that. And now, not only on that weekend that another Man United manager's job might have been saved, he finally writes his own story in the FA Cup by bringing Coventry to the semi-final, because Mark Robbins has done an excellent job at Coventry, but it's flown under the radar, you know, a little bit. Considering where Coventry were beforehand, he's done a tremendous job. But now he's got his own story, because he was just literally, whenever anybody mentioned Mark Robbins' name, it was, well, he saved Fergie. Saved Fergie's job. So a very interesting weekend for him as well. Before I go on about Coventry, you've got a list.
So when I saw that goal go in, that felt like a truly special moment. And for an American to be at the center of it, obviously for me as an American soccer fan, it felt even more special. I tweeted right away, wow, trying to think of a list of the biggest goals scored by an American for a club team. Not sure where this ranks, but a 100th minute goal for a second tier side away to a Premier League club with a trip to Wembley on the line feels like it should be on that list.
Yeah.
So I thought about it. Now, admittedly, this is like back of the napkin type stuff. I can't say I went through like the encyclopedia of American soccer history. So I'm sure I have missed some here, and I'm enlisting help. I'm not saying that my list is just gospel. I want help from the people for the ones that you think I've missed. But
I've already helped you, by the way.
So here are the five. I'll say right now, you just heard the Haji Wright one, so I won't play it again. I have that in top five. I have it fifth. Maybe that's recency bias. Maybe a lot of this list is, but I have that one fifth. Number one, JJ, it's one of my favorite goals ever scored, certainly by an American player. I put number one Clint Dempsey for Fulham when they completed their unbelievable comeback against Juventus in the Europa League in 2010. Yeah. Here's what that one sounded like.
Dempsey. And Dempsey will try and chip one. Wonderful! Absolutely brilliant! A sensational goal from Clint Dempsey. May well have knocked Juventus out.
What a goal that was.
Incredible. I mean, just the chip over the keeper, the drama of it. They won that second like 4-1. It was a ridiculous comeback against Juventus, for God's sake. Fulham. Number two, JJ, one of the greatest rivalries in all of world football, and to see an American score the winner at the very end of stoppage time. I put Maurice Adu's last second goal for Rangers against Celtic. I put that number two on my list.
Kevin Thompson's corner. It's Bagheera! Borat stops it! Boyd! Adu has put it in! Maurice Adu! Right at the end! And Rangers take a giant leap towards
and that was crucial in them going on to win the league that year, right?
Yep. Yeah, I think that one was in February, so there was still some league to go, but yeah, it was a huge one. Number three on my list, I have Christian Pulisic scoring for Chelsea in the Champions League semifinals against Real Madrid. First leg, 14th minute, he got the scoring started for Chelsea. Here was that one.
He's found Pulisic. There's no flag here. It's Christian Pulisic. Courtois held him up, but Pulisic has scored! And Chelsea take the lead.
Yeah, that's a crucial goal on the way to winning the trophy.
Yeah. And then number four, this was a little help from you when I was kind of digging through and trying to decide. You submitted this one, and you're right. It should definitely be on there. 88th minute, Champions League quarterfinals, Leipzig and Atletico Madrid. It's tied, and Tyler Adams on a big deflection, but still counts just the same. Tyler Adams sent Leipzig through.
Tom by Sabitzer, and Angelino has got him behind here, and he's got support from Adams. It's in. 2.5 minutes left to play. Leipzig are in front. Tyler Adams, with the help of a deflection, has scored the goal, which has put Leipzig on the verge of their first Champions League semi-final.
Yeah, it's one that's probably been forgotten, as well as the Pulisic one, except by us, obviously. But because they were played in the COVID tournament-y times, empty stadia, etc., it's easy to forget about them, but they were crucial goals.
Yeah, so I'm sure, I mean, I have in front of me, I won't read them off here, but I do have the other ones that I was considering. But I'll be curious to hear from the people on what should be on there, because I will admit that there is a little bit of recency to this one. Was there some like Chirundolo goal for Hanover that I've forgotten? Like, help me. I want to see them. Send me the videos of them. I want to see the ones that you think I've left off that should have been on there. It should be noted, by the way, while we're talking about Haji Wright, his good weekend didn't end there. Now, unfortunately, it came at someone else's expense. Josh Sargent was forced to pull out of the Nations League with an injury, and he scored again. And then he suffered the injury. He's scoring every week, Josh Sargent. It's incredible. Both he and Luca De La Torre both suffered injuries, dropped out of the side. So Haji Wright and Brendan Aaronson were both ushered in. I should say, with regards to Wright, we've talked about, but with regards to Aaronson, we were hard on him. We said that this, you know, him not making this team was kind of unthinkable a year ago, 2 years ago, and now his career has kind of gone the wrong way. Over the weekend, I don't know if it was from the snub of not having made the team or what, but he was brilliant for Union Berlin in their 2-1 win over Werder Bremen. He scored a goal, which is not something he's done frequently at club play this season. I think it was only his second. But even aside from that, I mean, look, every player's highlight reel can look great, like just ask Sergiño Dest. But Brendan Aaronson was truly brilliant in this game. So who knows? Maybe you never know the things that will spur on motivation in somebody. Maybe not making that initial roster did that for him. I'll be curious how the rest of the season goes, but he gets back in the team. Also, by the way, Ricardo Pepi scored the winner this weekend for PSV. Quite a weekend. Quite a weekend for Americans abroad. There you go. That's the FA Cup. Semifinals will be at Wembley, of course. Manchester City versus Chelsea and Manchester United against Coventry City. What a quarterfinal that was.
Yeah, just one final point on Coventry. They're very much in and amongst the enemies here, and the enemies of not only just in terms of, well, they're our rival, we're playing them, they're the opposition in a game, but they're in amongst the Premier League. And it's only this week, or just last week, actually, where the Premier League voted, or didn't vote, didn't even bother to vote, rejected a £900 million sterling package that would be distributed amongst the EFL Championship to support clubs down there. Hmm. They didn't even hit the number that they needed to get it to a vote, or to a discussion, and they rejected it outright, and they've asked for the EFL to come back with something else for them. And it's interesting that Coventry are there, because Coventry are a club, like I said, were a relative Premier League mainstay until the early 2000s. They were relegated, they left their ground Highfield Road, and they built a new stadium, the Ricoh Arena, at the time. Since then, they've had to mortgage that out. They almost lost their stadium. They've been a club completely in the wilderness. And to see them back where they are now is an unbelievable story. But it just kind of goes to show you the complete disconnect of and greed of Premier League clubs. Like, this should be a matter of urgency to support the pyramid below them. Like, the English football exists because of the pyramid and the structures that have been there. And it's just funny. They are literally amongst the enemy right now, because some of the clubs were London clubs that voted against it. And I think Liverpool were involved as well that basically said Arsenal are amongst, this is from Football London, so it's a London centre thing. Arsenal are amongst 10 Premier League teams who voted against a financial deal to support the English Football League, according to a recent report. They met on Monday to vote on a potential deal that could help the 72 EFL clubs. However, the vote didn't even happen after half of the league decided it wasn't worth discussing, and there's talk of a potential legal fight against the government. So yeah, it's just interesting to me, you know.
And the rift grows.
The rift grows, and those of us who are so madly opposed to a Super League, there's one going on underneath our noses right now, and it's one that's trying to be exclusionary and as unhelpful as possible to those below it.
Oh, there you go. We'll go ahead. We'll take a break. Theo Lloyd-Hughes will join us shortly to help discuss the first weekend of NWSL and look ahead to the season at large. Premier League, a few things that we want to touch on. Still a lot to do here on Caught Offside. Don't go anywhere.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Oh, back now on Caught Offside. JJ, a little bit of breaking news. I'll admit, yeah. I'm still kind of digesting this and have not had a chance to dive into the report. But as we started recording today, the news came down that Nottingham Forest, we now know their point deduction, and it's going to be a 4-point deduction. So they do drop into the bottom three. They're 18th now. Luton Town move 1 point ahead of them into safety. So it is very much a race still. If you were looking for some kind of 10-point deduction like what Everton were initially given and sending Nottingham Forest into sure thing relegation, that is not the case. It's a fight. It's going to be a fight to the death for those two teams to see who's going to manage to stay up. So my initial thoughts on this, like I said, I don't have the details on it yet, and maybe by the time you're listening to this, you know. I do find it a little bit interesting. Nottingham Forest, so their spending was £34.5 million, I believe, over the threshold, and they received a 4-point deduction. Everton, you might remember, initially were given a 10-point deduction. That was knocked down to 6. They were only, I think, £19 million over the threshold. Mm. So Nottingham Forest was almost double, from a financial perspective, what Everton were in terms of how far over the threshold they went, and yet their punishment is 2 points less than what Everton's wound up being, and Everton had to appeal that down. I haven't seen much. I just saw that part of it. In the statement it says that Nottingham Forest were extremely cooperative.
Yes,
I guess in some ways that was part of this. I think it also says something about them having tried to mitigate their wrongdoing. So maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know. I will say, just from looking at it without diving into those details and just seeing the bare bones of it, you always say, JJ, that there's this feeling to all this that it's being made up as we go along.
Yeah.
This, just looking at it this way, this outcome does not help that. Having seen Nottingham Forest go further than Everton did over the threshold and get less of a punishment there, like, that doesn't dispel that notion to me that this is all kind of like, I don't know, on any given day, the point deduction could be any given number on how we're feeling. I don't know, like, the level of cooperation. I don't know, were Everton obstructing? I think that they had denied that. Clearly that matters greatly. But yeah, I think for Nottingham Forest, I guess that's a win. Your season is still very much alive, but so there you go. We were waiting for resolution.
I think
with them.
Well, I mean, both clubs, basically what happens is both clubs admitted, they just say, put their hands up. Yeah, we're over, but here's the mitigating circumstances. And I guess Forest's mitigating circumstances were more convincing than Everton's. That's the only thing you can deduce from that. Everton have another round coming, so we have to see what's going to happen there.
Yeah.
Throughout the process, this is from the Athletic, Forest feel as though they've gone out of their way to work with the Premier League to accept that they have breached regulations, but to explain what they believe were mitigating circumstances, largely surrounding the sale of Brennan Johnson late in the window. But amid the frustration at a time when Forrest have felt hard done by over a number of controversial refereeing decisions, there will also be an understanding that the punishment might have been more severe, which is pretty much what you're alluding to there. So we'll have to, we'll read more. We'll get back to it on Thursday, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Interesting. All I know is there is a burly Greek man screaming at somebody. That's just the way it is. That will be happening as we speak.
Let's see. Quick Premier League notes. Not a ton here. Do want to obviously mention Fulham destroying Tottenham. I mean, what was that? That was from Spurs coming off of their Aston Villa performance, yeah, which was probably their best of the season. This was, I mean, I think I've watched every game they've played this year. This, for me, was their worst.
Right, but it was an open game, and on another day, Tottenham could have scored three themselves. I mean, the XG was 3.12 Fulham, 2.48 Tottenham.
Yeah, so
but Madison,
I don't have much use for that, because those Tottenham chances, like Timo Werner's, who was the other one? It was 3-0.
James Maddison could have opened the score on 30 minutes when Odoghi set him up. And then it's a different game.
Fulham could have opened it a minute and 45. Fulham could have had six in this game. Realistically.
Yeah,
surprised their XG number is low, and Tottenham's is hollow and empty to me, because a lot of those chances that boosted it came when this game was done. So I heard that XG number before we started recording. I was listening to A View from the Lane, and they mentioned that. They were like, well, Tottenham had their chances. And I kind of went back and dug on, and I was like, well, wait a minute. The Timo Werner one probably boosted it significantly. The other one that was put just wide by Richarlison, that's who it was. The game was over when those things happened. So, sometimes you can just tell, at least for me, early on, you could tell something is off today with this team. Second minute, weird, sloppy pass from Madison. A ball that has no chance of getting through in a relatively dangerous part of the field. I don't know what he's doing. Immediately, it springs Fulham back the other way. They nearly go up 1-0. And so right away, it's kind of like, okay, that was weird. That was the whole game. Sloppy. Yeah. So many poor touches. The number of misplaced passes, I'd have to look. I'd like to find the statistics. But Tottenham's passing in the midfield, it was just so poor. Total absence of sharpness. Just a very weird, not at all what you just saw from them against Villa in their best game of the season. And look, it's another loss with Van de Ven not in the starting 11. And, you know, that's obviously a big deal. And Tottenham conceded three, and Dragozin wasn't great in this game. But, I can't just look at this loss and say, well, if Van de Ven's there, it's a different story. It didn't feel like that. It just felt like Fulham could do whatever they wanted. Again, Tottenham's midfield, which is usually a strength, Bissouma looked slow. The passing was just so poor. I mean, it was 3-0. It could have been so much worse. Brendan Johnson losing possession on the edge of his own third. Bissouma's late to pounce on the loose ball. Here come Fulham. The only thing that prevented that from being a goal, Christian Romero blocked the shot from point blank range at 7 yards out. You know, that should have been 1-0 right there. I mean, it could have been who was it? Anthony Robinson blowing by defenders, centers for Muniz, who just missed it. He whiffed on a ball inside the 6 yard box with.
By the way,
keeper out of the goal. I mean, this could have been 3-0 in the 24th minute. So I don't want to hear about XG and Tottenham and all that.
Well, you've told me.
They were terrible. They were terrible.
As an American, I want to mention Robinson's ball for the first goal was so good. It was so good. And it still had to be controlled, because it skips up off the turf. Muniz, it just takes a brilliant first touch and the volleys it low and hard past the keeper. Vicario, it's a really, really great goal.
I like him a lot. Not Robinson. You know how I feel about Robinson. I love him. Rodrigo Muniz, I like that guy.
But they've been crying. He hasn't started that many games this season. He had a few injuries. He's got seven lately. He looks like what they were missing in the earlier half of the season.
Well, because they lost Mitrovic, and I don't think that they were ready for that.
No,
Muniz, I mean, Muniz, he's got seven goals in his last seven games. You know, Fulham's weird. I was watching this game. I was just like, they're wild. Yes, we're playing. Tottenham are playing awfully, but they're good. They are really good. So it made me wonder about Fulham. Are they underachieving? Are they overachieving? Are they exactly where they should be? They're 12. They've won 11 games. They've lost 13, and they've drawn five. They handed Tottenham and Arsenal, probably both of those teams, I think both fan bases would say their worst losses of the season were against Fulham. They had back-to-back 5-0 wins on their resume, one of which against West Ham and then Forest. They beat United at Old Trafford. They smashed Brighton 3-0. In addition to beating Arsenal, they drew with them, so they haven't lost to Arsenal this season. They probably should have beaten Liverpool. Even Klopp said after that, he didn't understand how Liverpool won. He said, we scored four great goals. I don't know. Yeah. They were all, you know, goals from like 20 yards out. Like
They were worldies.
So then you look at that and I'm like, how did this team lose to get shut out by Burnley, get killed by Bournemouth? Like Fulham are, they're kind of weird. I mean, I guess the answer is like, they're probably where they should be. They're good enough to do these things, but like they're not loaded with talent. So like you're just not going to be great every week and you're going to have those vulnerable moments where you get punished. They're an interesting team though.
They don't concede much at home, which is massive for them. But their away form, I suppose, hasn't been up to things. Listen, we got to get to watch. Before we get to NWSL, we have to get to what Ange said, Andrew.
Please. So you want to talk about this? I wasn't sure.
We have to talk about this. Yeah, because it came up on our pod. And I went back I went back and forth with a listener in a friendly manner. And by the way, before you start rolling your eyes, Justice Lloyd West. By the way, what a great name. Good Lord. So yeah, we went back and forth about these very comments in another friend of the pod's Twitter thread. Max Bretos was on about it, kind of backing up what Big Ange had to say.
The backdrop to this quickly is that Tottenham announced last week that they're raising season ticket prices, I think by 6%, and they're also doing away with their concessions for older fans over the age of 65. The reduced rates for those fans are gone and ticket prices are going up for everyone. And fans are irate. And it was particularly frustrating to hear that because it came in a time where Tottenham were really playing well. You're feeling good about the club. And then bang, they come in with something really deeply negative like that.
But we should mention Fulham fans, because we just talked about Fulham. They've been raging from the start of the season at their ticket prices. Have you seen some of Fulham's prices are... Come on, absolutely. Yeah. It's gouging.
Yeah. So that was the backdrop. And then, so I think the sense is a lot of maybe there's this feeling of local fans being priced out at the expense and benefit of fans from not from the area, not from London, whatever, fans who are coming in from other parts of the world. And so the question was phrased in a way of, let's see, this is from The Athletic. Spurs head coach Ange Postecoglou has hit back the idea irregular visitors to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium are plastic or tourist supporters. Here's Ange's full comments.
See, that's really harsh, yeah? Because I'll tell you why. Because I'm probably plastic and touristy, because I was coming from the other side of the world, really passionate about football. And if I could get access to see a Premier League game, that was the world to me. So to label people plastic or tourists, I don't think that's fair. Just because people live on the other side of the world. This football club has supporters all over the world, have supporters all over the UK that don't always get access to the games. And I think we should always have the ability to accommodate them and give them that feeling of, you know, it doesn't make them any less passionate. I think it's really disrespectful to call fans who are willing to go to the expense of coming halfway around the world. You don't know how passionate they are about their football club. That doesn't diminish who they are, I don't think.
JJ, I will certainly let you have your say on this because sure. I know this is something that you were kind of on the other side of.
No, that's not right.
That is exactly right.
Not right.
But I will say that there were probably a lot of American soccer fans out there who are obsessive Premier League fans who do wake up early and have spent a lot of money to travel.
Who
and go
is
to
arguing any of that?
And, like, that we're, that
completely misrepresenting
comments.
Me here now.
Then represent yourself.
Right. What I said was that the local fans should get priority. Okay? Always and forever. Those are the people who literally built those clubs. Those are the people who are there week in, week out. Those are the people who create the atmosphere, the sounds, the songs that make the grounds, the global... popular, attractive thing that makes the foreign fan want to come in and watch. I never said a foreign fan isn't as passionate or doesn't care as much. Never said that. And I don't think they're plastic. And I think that term plastic is such, when it comes to sports, it can be quite a nasty thing to say about someone. I believe you can be a Man United fan in Utah and care just as much about the club. All I'm saying is that local fans should get priority. And that's, and I mean that. But I'll take it away. So me and Justice had that conversation and we're more or less on the same page. And I tweeted this, and my friend who is a regular at Celtic Park, Brian, he got involved, and he made the best point about all of this. He said, in a lot of cases, the resentment from a lot of local fans seems to be the perception slash reality that they are being priced out of going to the games. That vacuum will be filled by someone and it will create tension. That is the whole point there. It's not as if armies of fans are taking tickets away. It's the fact that the tickets are so expensive for the locals. And if you're coming from Japan or Des Moines or anywhere, and you know, you've planned and you've paid for a big trip, you can afford to do it because you've put that money aside. Sure. But the fan that wants to go week in, week out, it's impossible for them to do that now. And that is the thing that Ange is not acknowledging there. That is the problem. It's not about the foreign fan being less passionate or plastic or anything about that. It's the perception that they are taking the seat that if it was ordinarily priced, would go to the local person.
And that's probably the problem with the way the question was phrased. Because my guess is Ange would probably agree with a lot of what you're saying there. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but using a term like plastic is going to be viewed as an offensive term, especially when you're talking to a guy who's not from there,
right,
who has been accepted by these people. And so, like, I think he latched on to that and wanted to make sure he defended whether it's his fellow Fair. Australian fans or American fans or Japanese, South Korean.
Yeah.
I mean, Lord knows the number of the South Korean market with what Heung-min Son has meant to Spurs. I mean, it's incredible.
Sure.
So I think he needed to make sure that he defended those fans from a term that is not fair. But
it's not fair.
But what you have said there is also true. And I think he probably would agree. I think reasonable people could agree with what you're saying there.
I think so. And like, it's such a tricky one to solve now. It's not actually that tricky. Clubs are making so much money from TV and other streams of revenue. Give the people who come into the stadium a break, and then everybody can be happy. Then everyone, then John and Linda from Texas can go to a game and not feel like there's people outside who are embittered because they feel they should be there too. It probably is just a case of curb the greed.
Yeah, I mean, look, the secondary market is a gift and a curse. I mean, we all use it to buy our tickets, but by the same token, like that's a lot of what drives up these prices. Who are the people that are putting these tickets up to be purchased at these inflated rates by fans coming in from overseas?
How do you police that? That's tricky.
I don't know. I have no idea. But yeah.
Sorry for getting angry at you.
You're allowed. It's all right.
I got snippy. Wasn't nice.
Well. I'm just trying to stand up for our Midwestern listeners that you've offended in the past on this subject.
Stop that. By the way, 40 of 50 states, Andrew, we have sold merchandise in 40 of the 50 states.
Really? Who are the, I need to know the 10. We have to call out the 10.
I'm not, it's weird because I didn't get a chance to look through what are the states we're missing? But like you might say, well, there mightn't be that many people in, say, like North Dakota that have bought. But there is. There's people in North Dakota buy it. I'll get the map out. I'll check it out.
Okay.
And we will publicly shame the other 10 states.
Let's see. Quickly here, JJ, just a couple things in MLS. Wanted to mention this. I must say, our Minnesota United FC listeners, they are like, we'll sometimes get, you know, the messages from people that want us to talk about their clubs, and it can be rude. You know, it can be like, you know, the Liverpool Tottenham show, you'll do everything on them, but you can't spare us 3 minutes. Do better, you know. But Paul Risdell, I got to give him credit because he's a longtime listener, and he wants Minnesota United FC to be discussed, and they're not all that often. And he's adamant about it, but not in a way that is offensive or angry. He tweeted me. He said, "Hey, @AGunling, how about a shout out for Minnesota United FC for being joint top of the league, having already played both teams from last year's MLS Cup, and also just hiring the youngest coach in MLS history and just getting our best player, Reynoso, back from injury." He's right. They absolutely deserve a shout out. Robin Lud scored on a free kick early on. Great ball played in from deep. And then the Loons got another late one off an LAFC mistake to win it 2-0. They've won three. They've drawn another against Columbus to start out the season. You know, look, I know Eric Ramsey, their new man, the new coach coming in from Manchester United, he's getting a lot of the accolades. He won his first game. There's a lot of excitement around him. You know, they've talked about his energy. I know I'll talk about Ten Hag. Ten Hag thinks really highly of him as well. I'll mention that in a sec. But I do want to give a shout out to Cameron Knowles, who was holding down the ship before Ramsey got there as the interim manager who got this started off. And Ramsey is now continuing that. Even this game that they won, he only barely got, I think he was there for 4 days. A lot of this was the work that Cameron Knowles did, who's gone back to the assistant role. But I wanted to make sure he got mentioned as well, because the rest of the season is going to be all about Ramsey as one of these new, young, up-and-coming managers. And Ten Hag really liked him a lot and did not want him to go. This is from the Mirror. Ten Hag considered Ramsey to be one of his top coaches at United, but knew it was only a matter of time before he left. Ramsey had been approached by both Swansea and Blackpool since the start of 2024, but on both occasions, Ten Hag had convinced him to stay. The Dutchman expressed his desire for Ramsey to remain at United again when Minnesota came calling, but this time the coach decided to take on his first head coaching role. Ramsey has a vast amount of experience despite being just 32, which began when coaching his university team alongside current Ipswich Town manager Kieran McKenna.
Yeah.
So for 32 years old, there's a lot of people out there who think pretty highly of this guy, and it's a fun thing, and it's cool to see him doing it in MLS after spurning a couple clubs over in England.
And also, like, could be interesting. Yeah, but like the brain drain from United, Jesus, yeah. Like Ipswich and Minnesota. By the way, Minnesota on Wednesday are playing St. Pat's Athletic from the League of Ireland, the greatest league in the world, plays the other greatest league in the world in a game, and Minnesota United. Tweeting out Chucky R. Law, which is our, which translates as "Our day will come," is a Irish Republican slogan, which I'm not sure everyone will be happy was tweeted. But Minnesota United, I don't know if they've removed the tweet, but they in promoting Minnesota playing St. Patrick's Athletic on in this friendly, which they're tying into obviously St. Patrick's Day, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, they tweeted Chucky R. Law.
Nice.
Don't keep saying Republican IRA slogans, JJ. You said it once, that's enough.
Interesting. By the way, before we get out of MLS, can we just talk for one moment, JJ, about the most ridiculous match-winning goal I think I've ever seen in my life? Kellen Acosta. So there's 9 minutes of stoppage time. They're at like 98-30 or something. He's got the ball at midfield. Here, just listen to it.
Here comes Chicago one more time. Acosta forward, and it's an awkward moment. Oh my word! Chicago Fire have won it. The Windy City plays its part.
This goal is so ridiculous. It's dumb. It's amazing. It's embarrassing. It's incredible. It's everything. From midfield, he's not even running towards goal. I think he's just thinking he's lumping a ball deep. It gets caught up. I think Max Bretto said something like the ball got caught in a jet stream. I don't know what it was, but the ball just keeps going and going. Now, look, the keeper is caught out, but he doesn't expect the ball to carry the way that it does. There's a curve to it. One of the fans in Chicago for this game, if you can go on Twitter and just search for Kellen Acosta, you'll see the camera angle taken from behind the goal. And the way this ball curves, I don't know. It's like... I have not seen anything like it. I haven't seen a game end in that kind of fashion before. It was 3-1 Montreal in the 82nd minute.
My God.
This game was over. Raheem Edwards then gets red carded for an elbow. And then the rest is history. Chicago scores 3 goals in the final, what was it, like 12 minutes or so. And then the last one deep in stoppage time. Kellen Acosta, can it be goal of the season if it's by accident and utterly ridiculous?
Let me have a look because I didn't actually see this.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable.
Oh my, what? Oh, goalie. Oh my God, the goalie gets done.
But like, how can he know though? How can he know that that's going to happen?
That is lake effect wind. That is lake effect wind clipping that one in. That is the stupidest goal I've ever seen. He's not
to
even
win
shooting.
The game. It's to win the game. It was in the 99th minute.
He's clipping it forward. What is the goalie doing?
But I can't even blame him.
It's caught in the jet stream. He could have still caught it, Andrew. He could have still caught it. What are you doing, sir? Oh, no. That's awful.
It's an unbelievable.
That goes into your folder of MLS goalkeeping errors.
But I don't even want to blame him because no one in their right mind is he's trying to read that ball. Maybe he's coming for it, seeing like, okay, this is going to get in the box. I'm going to catch it and smother it, and we'll get out of here with a 3-3 draw. But it just kept going. And he's trying to backpedal last second as like, I don't know. It was just written in the stars.
Can I quickly jam in some Inter Miami?
Oh my God.
So they play DC United. They win 3-1. But like DC United on the half hour, like they could have been up 4-0. Benteke, again, added to the list of players. Is he good? Is he bad? Is he washed? Don't know. He should have scored an absolute bucketful. Left it too late. it's a case of Taylor coming off, Suarez coming on, and he has a cameo to, you know, obviously they'd equalize, but he has a cameo, two goal, a brace, they call it in the profession, to win the game. His second goal, the third Miami goal to win it. Again, it's another one where I'm like, is this actually any good what I'm watching here? He turns like the Titanic. He turns like a man with knees that are severely paining him, goes to clip the goalkeeper. The goalkeeper's got to do better. He's got to, he gets too much of a hand on it. It goes over the line. He tries to save it. Anyway, there we go. 3-1 Inter Miami. I'm just watching this thing until it explodes. Because
what surprises me is the way you're rooting for that. It's one thing to think that it could happen.
It could
I'm a little
be really
surprised
funny.
that you want it to happen.
It could be so funny. They're hugely entertaining. But again, I watch their games with levels of disbelief. And Red Bull, just quickly, clipped by Columbus. Now, Columbus are a very good side, but I would say the era of good feelings is now, I won't say it's ended for the New York Red Bulls, but it's been curbed somewhat by a chastening versus the Columbus crew.
Let's see, JJ, we continue now. Of course, that was some MLS. Let's go now to NWSL. It made its return over the weekend. So let's talk about it and what we should expect this upcoming season. And let's do so with one of our favorites, a guy who covers the league so incredibly well. We love talking women's soccer with him. It's Theo Lloyd-Hughes back on the program now. Theo, what's up, man? How are you?
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. Well, we're thrilled to have you back, especially at the start of this NWSL season. I'm sure it's a busy time for you. So let's get right into it. Now, so the season is underway, of course, but I want to go back just a little bit, back into the offseason. A lot of eye-catching moves went down over the last few months, I'd say. What are the ones that kind of caught your eye the most?
Yeah, I mean, I think the headline, which maybe many of your listeners will know about, is obviously Gotham picking up the free agents, the four USA players, Emily Sonic, Crystal Dunn, Deanna Davidson, and who am I forgetting?
That's Rose Lavelle.
Thank you. And she's arguably the biggest of them all. top marks. So yes, you know, that's the big one, which obviously coming off a championship win and a sixth place finished and playing some fabulous football, you know, a few people are maybe saying, oh, did they sign too many stars? You know, the phrase super team, you'd have to, you know, coach me up on MLS, how we've seen super teams in the past. But, you know, they're not always successful, right? They can create a lack of balance, maybe a lack of defined roles, cohesion, all these sort of things. So Gotham's big offseason has definitely been a big talking point. We got two new expansion clubs, and I think seeing their strategy, their additions, has been really interesting. And we saw Bay FC get their first win of the season yesterday. Fantastic win with Asiset Oshawala scoring a fabulous goal. Her only shot of the game, which I thought was interesting. You know, a historic goal for that club. But, you know, they spent the entire second half backs against the walls, kind of clinging on for their life. And they obviously get the massive win. Utah, the other expansion club, maybe a less flashy offseason. We didn't see any big signings. We didn't see the Oshawala, Rachel Kudanunji. Another Bay FC signing broke the world record transfer fee, $800,000. So Bay FC going out there, splashing the cash, getting some big names. Utah gone for a very different approach. And actually didn't play too badly. They dominated Chicago at home, but lost 2-0 with maybe a mixture of sort of a few proven veterans in the NWSL and some young kids with a lot of talent. But definitely two very different approaches we're seeing in Utah and Bay in the transfer window and during the offseason. And I suppose maybe the big narrative away from player transfers is it was an offseason of coaching acquisitions, big name coaches coming into the league. And there is kind of a feeling talking to people, both fans, media, and the players themselves, really, that the coaching has never been better in the NWSL. The personalities, the coaching ability. You know, Vlatko Andonovski, you know, I'm sure your listeners know of him. A bit maligned for the way things ended for the US, but still considered a very good coach, especially liked by a lot of the players. He comes in to Kansas City, opens that new stadium, big win at the weekend. Lorne Donaldson, another one at the World Cup, who had a very good time, unlike the Americans. He's now in Chicago. People are really excited to see him. And then you've got, you know, former players, Bev Yanez in Louisville, Emi Rodriguez in Utah. These are coaches with not much experience. This is their first proper jobs. But, you know, fans are really excited to see them. The players are really excited to see them. So off-season narratives, we're talking, you know, big money was getting spent in California and Orlando. Big free agents were being signed in New York. And across the league, we're seeing a lot of exciting coaches.
Theo, we've got... the game that stood out for me was the 5-4. So I have to go to that. Casey Current and the Portland Thorns. Now, like for me, I have just a perception of Portland as one of the kind of preeminent teams in the league. And this was such a defensive shambles. I've had to break this down into two parts. A, am I going to have to recalibrate how I look at Portland going forward? And B, are the Current really that good? And now I know the scoreline 5-4 seems as if Portland were more in it, but really, I mean, it was Casey Current that kind of dominated this one. So I suppose, where are Portland at? Is this an accurate reflection, or was it just a bad day at the office? And are Casey as good as they looked?
I think if you've been watching Portland for at least the last year, maybe the second half of last year, let's say, maybe not even a full year, they've always been quite leaky at the back. You know, five goals to a Kansas City team that finished 11th last year, that's not going to look great. But this Portland team is really struggled to defensively. I think they conceded, off the top of my head, about 30, 32 goals, maybe the fourth worst, third worst defense last year in the NWSL. They make up for it by having Sophia Smith, scored another brace, arguably the MVP, front runner, you know, was the MVP in 2022, incredible player who missed 8 weeks with a knee injury last year. So maybe, again, back end of last year, you lose Sophia Smith and that defense isn't as good. And, you know, there are problems in Portland. They've got a talented squad, but I don't think it's crazy to be like, you know, defensively, Portland are not great. Yesterday, they handed debuts to Müller and Oblaze, who I thought, as you can tell from the scoreline, really struggled. I think Bia Zanaretto, the Kansas City forward, who's brand new, she looked fantastic. So kind of on the flip side, Kansas City getting some offensive help there. And the way she turned Oblaze, I think for the second or third goal, it really was like a welcome to the NWSL moment. Transition, turnover, you know, verticality, that long ball, quick switch, and she just absolutely blasted past her. So, you know, I think it was a very NWSL game, lots of errors, lots of mistakes, high turnovers, counter-attacking football, and, you know, there wasn't really that much in it, right? I think Kansas City were definitely much better, but once Dabina went off with that injury, the game kind of leveled out a little bit, and, you know, Thorns made it interesting at the end. But I think it was just wonderful chaos. Great to see some kids out there from Kansas City as well. You know, we talked about, obviously, Bia Zanaretto being a big Brazilian signing for them. But Ellie Wheeler from the draft looked great. Claire Hutton was fantastic. She's only 17. You know, and Alex Pfeiffer, the youngest ever goal scorer at 16, comes off the bench and scores as well. So Vlatko's playing the kids, which I think will be really exciting. Another big theme of the NWSL as people kind of ditch the draft and we're seeing all these young kids come in, I think is really exciting. But kind of going back to your original thing, Portland, this should be up there, but defensively they got a lot of issues. Becky Sauerbrunn didn't play today, but she's obviously aging out, and a lot of US fans will remember the Mexico game a few weeks ago where she kind of got put under a lot of pressure as well. Yeah. So Portland, yeah, maybe we'll see a big defensive signing from them this season.
Theo, just sort of tangentially before we leave that Kansas City Current Portland Thorns match, it was a big occasion for Kansas City.
Massive.
Debuting this new purpose-built stadium specifically for women's professional soccer. Supposedly this is the first of its kind. Is there any reason to believe that is this the start of a new trend? Are we going to see more of this popping up around the country?
I think it'll be really interesting. I think, you know, everyone wishes they could do it. Bay FC, you know, we were just talking about them, expansion club, wishes they could do it. But trying to build a stadium in the Bay Area, much more difficult than trying to build a stadium in Kansas City. And I think Kansas City is sort of perfectly primed with the ownership they have, who, to be fair, have put a lot of money in elsewhere, building a training center and kind of putting money into marketing and stuff. Like, you know, it's a full package deal. But I think you're going to see California clubs struggle to do what you could do in terms of real estate in Kansas City. Of course, you still have to put your money where your mouth is. So maybe other clubs, independent clubs, could do it elsewhere in the country, but I don't think we're going to see this across the United States kind of right now, unless maybe you get public funding. But we're seeing in Boston, another independent football group who want to come into the NWSL have a lot of trouble trying to acquire land from the city of Boston. So I think, I don't know, jury's out to kind of answer your question. Really, you know, credit to the Long ownership group and Brittany Mahomes for getting that stadium built. It was a fantastic occasion. The fans were amazing. It looks gorgeous. I think there's definitely criticism for the why they only built it to be 11,500. They sold out yesterday, and it's pretty much sold out for the whole season already. And the secondary ticket market's getting a lot of people mad when they could have just built it to be bigger. Obviously, it's brand new. So yeah, I think there's definitely a few criticisms there. I know some photographers said that the way it was built, like, doesn't look like they've given enough space to have photographers in as well. And just from watching it on my telly, I thought the pitch looked quite dry. And obviously maybe the grass might need a season or so to get in. But those are small complaints on otherwise an absolutely momentous day for women's sport worldwide. And I know that from talking to them, you know, the money they'll make off it and the way they'll be able to book a game, you know, whenever they want without having to think about a men's team or the people that own the stadium outright. It's an absolute game changer. And it should be a really big inspiration. And I just hope they can expand it and they can make it more affordable and, you know, get the pitch a bit better as well.
Theo, the other standout result for me was the North Carolina Courage smashing Houston Dash 5-1. We're always looking for these kind of things in the sports media, but is this a statement from North Carolina Courage to start the season?
They want it to be, mate. I think, you know, fans out there who are interested in getting into the NWSL, Sean Nahas and North Carolina Courage are definitely a fun team to kind of pick because he's spiky. He's always like barbs and pointing at the media for not giving his team enough coverage. So it's really interesting you say that because he wants that to be a statement. He wants that to be saying, my team, you know, we keep the ball in the deck, we play short passes, we look to go out and beat teams by, you know, multiple goals every week. I think that's what he wants it to be. I would argue that this weekend was more a sign that the Houston Dash are really lacking defensive quality and set up in a system under a new coach, Fran Alonso from Spain, that left a lot of space at the back and they were very naive to try and play out from the back. And we saw a lot of errors and a lot, I don't think every week you're going to see teams try and kind of willy-nilly play out the back without much practice first day of the season. And it's going to go as horribly wrong as that. So I don't know how much I say, you know, the Courage were absolutely fantastic. Obviously they beat a team that was struggling. And it was cool to see a lot of the goals come off the bench, actually. I think that was maybe the cool takeaway from the Courage game. I think four of the goals maybe actually came off the bench. That was kind of a good look.
Is there a team that you've seen from the weekend that people really aren't talking about, but you think they could make a run at this?
Oh, that's a good question. People aren't. I mean, Courage are probably the ones that, you know, don't really get enough press or people get mad about. I think the intriguing game of teams no one's really talking about that maybe people need to kind of check in on is Orlando and Racing Louisville. They drew 2-2. Orlando did very well. They were 2-1 down when Kylie Strom got sent off in the 70th minute, played the final 20 minutes with one less player and managed to get the comeback and steal a point. And they didn't even have their big signing, Barbara Banda, the Zambian forward who was signed for $750,000. So Orlando, I think, are a team for people to watch who obviously didn't get a win at the weekend, but have a really good squad and a really, really good coaching staff. And you know, they've just kind of added a star here and a star there, but they haven't changed the squad that much. And I think that continuity could go a long way.
Theo, I'm curious about San Diego. I mean, obviously we know they had a great season last year, but came up short in the postseason. Have they done the things that they would need to do to maybe rectify that looking ahead to this season?
I mean, I definitely think it's continuity in San Diego. I don't think they've changed the formula much at all. It's all about the spine. You know, Alex Morgan up top, Jaden Shaw in the midfield, Naomi Germer in defense, and Kaylin Sheridan in goal. That kind of spine down the middle, I think, is one of the best in the league. And obviously, in the dugout, Casey Stoney is you know, the best coach in the league or right up there. So, you know, I think they're sticking to their foundations. You could say it's a mentality issue maybe in those big games, in semifinals, in the playoffs when they haven't really got it done. But those games have also been really narrow. I think we also saw them struggle a lot last year in the league during the World Cup break, which again is, you know, you've got that spine of big internationals for Canada and the USA. And when they go away, how do you replace them? So I think what San Diego's tried to do, and I guess we'll find out if they've done it, is bring in depth pieces, players off the bench, players at the end of your 26-player squad that can contribute. Because I think that's where maybe they've come undone, is they're a little bit top-heavy. So at least Bennett, I think, will be an interesting player for people to watch who maybe, you know, casual fans don't know, but she was a cool off-season get for them who, you know, she started at the weekend, but I don't think she'll start every game, but how she's used off the bench will be really key.
Real quick, Theo, sorry, JJ, but you mentioned Casey Stoney there. I just wanted to kind of double up on that for a sec. Can you give us an insight? What kind of character is she? Her press conference after the Challenge Cup against Gotham was it was really something. Her kind of refusal to give in on having like truly lost last season was interesting. What can you give us some insight as to kind of what makes her tick? What she's like?
I mean, she's sort of no nonsense. Like, she's just, it's very refreshing, right? I mean, you guys probably sit in enough press conferences where you feel like people don't really say how they feel. They say the answer they feel like they should give, right?
Mm.
Casey just, she says how she feels, and it's so refreshing. And she, you know, when someone says something that she doesn't like, she kind of calls it out. Mm. And I think, you know, San Diego have been the best team consistently in the NWSL for the past two seasons. They have one shield and two semifinal playoff exits to show for it. And I think she's a little bit like trying to show, give herself some flowers because maybe she feels like no one else is. And obviously being from Europe, you know, to kind of touch on what you were saying, Andrew, like that topping the league at the end of the regular season in a way is a bigger achievement than winning the playoffs and AKA a championship. So yeah, she is kind of doubling down in a very kind of pantomime way in these press conferences by saying we won the league. We were the best team this year, last year, blah, blah, blah. But it's kind of just a testament to who she is and being someone that always gives her opinion, always tells it how it is, doesn't really mind winding media up. And she was like that as a player, you know, she's captain Arsenal, captain England, fantastic player, you know, hard as nails when she needs to be, no nonsense. And I think she really loves her players. And so kind of she has that respect. And if you have that respect from the dressing room, you can wind people up. And I think the NWSL is tremendously lucky to have Casey Stoney in it. She's box office. She'll give fans and media a lot of fun. And she just signed an extension to stay in San Diego till 2027 as well. So sit back and enjoy.
Theo, a slight diversion here because I need you to settle something for me. So we didn't get a chance to talk to you immediately after the Women's Gold Cup and the victory for the US Women's National Team. But myself and Andrew had a slight difference of opinion in its importance. So I felt that, you know, I mean, obviously winning is good, but I felt that this is the, I can phrase this much better, but it's say a kick from a dying horse. This is the end of an era and there are changes coming, big changes we expect with the arrival of Emma Hayes, whereas Andrew thinks this is a portent of the future because so many younger or newer stars were involved. Where are you at on that?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of column A and column B.
We need an answer.
I do think it's really hard to know. I don't have an answer to this. How much Emma Hayes' input there was. Because Emma Hayes in Chelsea press conferences said, you know, my mind is completely on Chelsea. I'm, you know, what's the US job? I'm focused on winning the Champions League, blah, blah, blah. But Twyla Kilgore sort of kept saying like, oh, I'm working with Emma and me and Emma are emailing and like,
right.
You know, there was this rumored visit to Florida where she went to a training session and like, it's all been really weird that the US kind of seemed to imply that she's like managing from afar, but Emma herself kind of claims that she's not doing anything. Okay. So I think it's really hard to answer your question just because like we're getting kind of mixed signals. I think what we saw at the Gold Cup was a little bit of let's play the kids and develop a new playing style. And right. Then they got a bit freaked out and decided that it was win at all costs. Let's get back to being, you know, some baddies. And I guess I kind of think the plan B is the only kind of thing you can do when you are in the room as a head coach and when you're that group of players and when you put your trust in someone like Alex Morgan. So I can only think it's actually less Emma just because the way it happened during the tournament felt so sudden that it would be weird if Emma from afar was like, okay, scrap it. Let's just get back to basics. But maybe there is a world where Emma's saying, you know, I'm only going to have 6 weeks in the job before they start the Olympics, so it's going to be basic. So I don't know. Maybe there was some email at 6 a.m. from London to say, hey, this is actually the lineup for the Colombia quarterfinal game. I don't know.
Yeah. I still think I'm right. So,
well, yeah, typical. Let's see, Theo, before we let you go, I won't ask you for a straight up prediction because who really knows, but it's
so hard. They, honestly, I mean, I know you deal with MLS, but it's like that doesn't feel like there's a less predictable league than the NWSL right now.
Well,
right.
I mean, last season was complete chaos until
chaos.
Everybody could have made the postseason at the end. So I won't ask you for a specific prediction, but is there, you know, we're right at the start of this thing here. Is there a storyline? Is there something that just kind of has you particularly intrigued as we head through the season?
I think the international players and the international vibe around the league is really exciting. I think how the NWSL positions itself as potentially the best league in the world, I think, is something I'm really interested in. And so to see these big transfer fees get paid this offseason, to see top coaches like Casey Stoney sign extensions, to see, you know, Barbara Banda, Rachel Kunanunji, Azizat Oshuala scoring SC, I thought was so cool. And you're seeing massive non-American names in the world again come here. You know, I think we forget, because it's 25, 30 years ago, but when the Premier League became the Premier League, part of that was because of the eyeballs in Asia, in the United States, in Africa. And what that then happens is creates kind of a surge on the inside because of money, because of influence, because of reputation, blah, blah, blah. Everyone wants to play there. And so if that happens in the NWSL in this season with the new broadcast deal and all these international names, I think is creating that buzz. I'm really interested to see if this is the season where it sort of changes and the NWSL can actually put itself out there as the best league in the world. Because for a long time, it's been highly entertaining, incredibly chaotic. But due to the salary cap and stuff like the draft, you just haven't really seen it being able to compare to, say, the Champions League or England or some of these other leagues where you just don't have those mechanisms that would keep some of the best players away. So if the draft, if the salary cap keeps going up and the influence of the draft keeps going down and the media keeps going up as well, suddenly the NWSL has the potential to sort of become the world's league. And I think that is really interesting.
Good stuff. We'll be watching that as well. It should be a really fun season. We appreciate you giving us some time to help educate us on what's to come. Theo Lloyd-Hughes, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Theo. I look forward to catching up with him all throughout the season, of course, and then the Olympics as well. All things women's soccer. He's so good. Make sure you follow him on Twitter or Instagram, everywhere. He covers the sport so well. We got to get out of here, JJ. This was a monster podcast. Before we go, though, one last thing. Another chapter in the If It Happened in the U.S., It Would Be the Biggest Story Ever book that I'm writing. Fenerbahce, they came from behind over the weekend to beat Trabzonspor 3-2. I don't know if they were behind, but it was 2-2. And then in somewhat controversial fashion, they got a late winner and won it 3-2. So fans were angry, and Fenerbahce then went to midfield and were celebrating after the game. They were kind of dancing and jumping up and down and celebrating, and Trabzonspor fans did not take kindly to it.
No.
One ran on the field and attempted to attack Fenerbahce player. Another fan grabbed the corner flag and looked like he was using it as a weapon, and next thing you know, I don't know how many people were on the field, but it's about as much as I've seen.
I'm watching Bright Osei Samuel, the defender, swinging a fist. The fan has obviously fallen to the ground. Or it looks like there's two fans there who are attacking him. He's got on top. He's straddling the two players, and he looks as if he's about to just land. He's lashing punches into the fans.
This was an unbelievable image. And look, I mean, security, it's easy for me to say, how can you allow this to happen? It has to be better. Yeah, like, when it's a couple fans, you could say, you know, how can this happen? But when there's an army of fans that have stormed the field, I don't know what you do here. This was so unacceptable. Gianni Infantino, this was not lost on him. The president of FIFA, he weighed in talking about this being absolutely unacceptable. One of the most incredible things in it, JJ, did you see Michy Batshuayi, formerly of Chelsea,
kicking at people?
It's like a full roundhouse.
Yeah.
It did not look like the first time he has done that.
No, but
it looked like a man with a martial arts background.
Listen, if you're trying to defend yourself, you're in a heightened state of fear for your existence. You're gonna do whatever you got in your locker.
When I looked it up on Twitter, I just wanted to see how many different like fan videos can I see of this. I'm just curious from like, because there's so many different skirmishes in different parts of the pitch. I was just trying to take it in. And so when I searched it, you know, you'll see different fans commenting. And there was one that said something like, this is embarrassing, punish the players, like something like that. And I was like, are you crazy? Nope. You are seeing this wrong, my friend. They just won a dramatic game on a late goal. They're allowed to celebrate. Okay?
Oh my God. Batshuayi's kick is awesome.
Right? It's a roundhouse.
Oh my God. The guy's running on and he swings like he's and catches him with the side foot.
Yeah.
And like up high.
Yeah,
he catches him just below the jawline, like into the shoulder, the chest. Woof.
Wow. I mean, it's full martial arts. Like, it's incredible. But this idea that, like, that Fenerbahce were somehow in the wrong, I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but from my vantage point, come on. Like,
there's
Trabzonspor, the punishment here has to, it's got to be, like, if this is not where you bust out the most severe level of punishment, then what are you waiting for? Like, unbelievable, crazy scenes over in Turkey. JJ, that's about all I got.
What a podcast, my God.
Yeah, we'll have another one later this week, probably late, I would assume late Thursday night, right, after the U.S. and Jamaica. So look forward.
It'll have to be. And for fans of not the U.S. men's national team, you're just going to have to bear with us. It'll be a Friday morning podcast when it gets to you. So, you know.
Yeah. But that's the way it goes. Nations League semifinal, U.S. Jamaica. We'll, of course, be all over that as we always are. JJ, I enjoyed this immensely. Our thanks to Theo Lloyd Hughes for joining us as well, getting us ready for NWSL. JJ, I hope your tears have dried. I hope the rest of your week is better than how your St. Patrick's Day was yesterday. To you, I say...
check you later, fun boy.
I'll see
you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.